Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Mark Hyman. Dr. Hyman is the medical director at Cleveland Clinic's Center for Functional Medicine, the founder of the Ultra Wellness Center, and a 10-time number one New York Times bestselling author. His wildly popular books include The Blood Sugar Solution, Ultra Metabolism, and Eat Fat, Get Thin. Mark also serves as medical editor for the Huffington Post and on the medical advisory board for the Dr. Oz Show. In 2011, working with Pastor Rick Warren, he helped the congregation of Saddleback Church collectively lose 250,000 pounds. His books and programs have radically improved the lives of millions of people, and I can't wait to hear what he's going to tell us today. So now, Mark, my dad and I are so happy that we have this time with you. And now for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thanks, Ocean. It's great to be here again.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to have you. And I want to start. We just learned very recently from internal sugar industry documents that were discovered by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, and that were published in JAMA, Internal Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association's publication, that the sugar industry paid scientists in the 60s to play down the link between sugar and heart disease. And it seems that since then, 5 decades of research into the role of nutrition and heart disease, including many of today's dietary recommendations, have been largely shaped by the sugar industry's obfuscation campaign. So, at the very least, they were able to derail the discussion about sugar for decades. So, Mark, is sugar the new tobacco?
Absolutely, John. I mean, this is an extraordinary story, and there's so many layers to it, and it's being fought at so many levels, at political levels, at community levels, and policy levels. The study you're talking about was pretty fascinating. It wasn't just any doctors. It was the leading nutrition physician of the time, who was the head of the Harvard, basically, nutrition program, and his colleague, that was Fred Stair, and Mark Hegstead was the other doctor, who were paid the equivalent of $50,000 in today's dollars, were colluding with them, did not disclose the sugar industry relationship, and basically made a case that sugar was not linked to heart disease, but it was actually fat. And that was because there was data emerging at the time that was proving the link between sugar and heart disease. And this guy, Mark Hegstead, eventually became part of the commission that was set up by McGovern, Senator McGovern, to create the first dietary guidelines. So this guy who was on the payroll of the sugar industry was the guy designing our first dietary guidelines. And I mean, it's just led to this enormous catastrophe we have now, where, you know, in 1960, we had 1 in 10 people who were obese in America. Now it's 1 in 3, and more than 2 out of 3 are overweight. It's really frightening. And the things that make, you know, sugar the new tobacco is that it's more addictive than cocaine. It causes disease. In fact, it causes more death and disease than tobacco globally, over $2 trillion a year. They actually operate, the food industry operates by the same playbook as the tobacco industry, by trying to obstruct change, to try to influence policy, to muddle the science, like they did in this study, to deny accountability, to sway public opinion. They co-opt public health. They lobby politicians.
Mark, this is so reminiscent of big tobacco, and it also reminds me of Exxon's suppression of its own research into climate change. Exxon's scientists knew for decades that there was a connection between fossil fuel consumption and climate change, but the company deliberately hid that research from the public. In so many ways, big tobacco and big oil and big sugar have been eager to suppress inconvenient information in the pursuit of their economic interests. They've also sought to create uncertainty and doubt about the science in order to reduce public support for meaningful regulation. Their goal ultimately has been to keep the public confused and to keep the government from regulating their industries. What I want to ask you, Mark, is can you give us an example of the sugar industry or of a company like Coke interfering directly in your efforts to help people eat less sugar and a more healthy diet?
So we went to Atlanta and met with Bernice King, who's Martin Luther King's daughter, and we wanted to have a fed-up screening of this movie, which is about sugar and this whole story. We wanted to have it at the King Center, which is all about civil rights and justice. And we set the whole thing up. We had it all going. And then we got a call. Sorry, you can't have it here. I'm like, why? They're like, Coca-Cola funds the King Center. I'm like, oh, God. And another story. There are all these soda taxes that are being out there pushed by advocates like Michael Bloomberg and the Arnold Foundation. And we can get into that more. But the food industry and the sugar industry fund all these organizations like the NAACP. So they won't come out in favor of the sugar tax. They fund, in fact, all the medical associations, the nutrition associations. So this whole situation is really pretty frightening. In fact, during the election, Hillary Clinton was coming out in favor of the soda tax in Philadelphia, which actually passed. And it was not just soda, it was also diet soda, which we can get into and why that's bad. And then immediately retracted it. And these emails were uncovered in the WikiLeaks thing that found that Coca-Cola was emailing her staff members who they knew saying, how could this happen? We've done so much for her. And she immediately retracted it. So that's the level that's actually going on. And I think, you know, someone once told me that sugar is sort of the karma of slavery, that actually much of slavery was built on the backs of the sugar trade. And so the sugar trade is now killing us. It's pretty frightening. The whole thing is pretty frightening.
It's an incredible story, and it affects all of our lives, sometimes in ways we don't even see. Presently, there are many countries, Denmark, France, Mexico, Hungary, Ireland, Iceland, Norway, South Africa. I mean, a lot of countries have adopted taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages.
That's right.
And the idea is that these taxes will both reduce consumption by raising the cost of these unhealthy beverages, and they'll provide a funding source for public health measures to fight obesity, to fight chronic disease, to educate the public about healthy eating, hopefully. Yeah. Now, in U.S. cities like Philadelphia, as you mentioned, San Francisco, Oakland, Boulder, Chicago, they've done the same thing. They have created soda taxes. But the soda companies and the American Beverage Council, which is the trade lobby for Coke and Pepsi, is spending enormous sums to oppose these taxes. And they claim that soda taxes unfairly hurt the poor.
Well, they call it grocery tax, right?
They do. And people are afraid, oh, their grocery bill will go up. And the truth is only if they buy these particular things that are killing them.
Yeah.
By and large, though, Americans seem split as to whether taxes on sugary drinks are a good idea. We're seeing the legislations pass in these various cities. But the indoctrination campaigns Coke and Pepsi and the American Beverage Council are paying for is effective in some ways. And people,
it is. It is. I mean, you think about it. The link between sugar-sweetened beverages and obesity and disease is greater than any other food substance. And sugar and starch also are a problem, but 47% of added sugars in our diet are from sugar-sweetened beverages. And, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not like regular food. It's not something you have to eat, right? And, you know, what they say that, you know, what the food industry is, you know, it's unlike tobacco and alcohol, which are taxed, you know, it's a food and you actually have to eat. You can't stop eating. But the truth is that sugar-sweetened beverages are not necessary for our survival. In fact, they're harming our survival. And they're, you know, the poor, they say, are the worst affected by this tax. But actually, the truth is they're going to benefit most from the reduction in soda consumption. And it actually works. You know, 1% payment or tax per ounce would cause a 10% reduction in sugar consumption.
Wow. And that would lower diabetes rates. It would lower obesity rates. Their kids would be able to focus better in school.
It's true. I mean, you know, there's so many downstream consequences on our economy, on our national security, on our global competitiveness, on kids' education. It's the biggest driver of our federal debt. And, you know, what's fascinating is that the sugar tax passed in like four places in this election. And Philadelphia passed before, and Berkeley had done just before that. It's starting to happen as a wave, and the food industry spent so much money on this. In just four cities, they spent $30 million fighting this. In Philadelphia, they had tried to pass a tax before. They gave $10 million to the hospital there to help them work on the problem of childhood obesity. It's crazy. And if we didn't have Michael Bloomberg and the Arnold Foundation, which are billionaires, they spent over $20 million fighting the soda industry's fight against the taxes. Pretty amazing.
It's amazing. It's just amazing. You mentioned this being the biggest driver of our national debt. I don't think it's nearly as often acknowledged as it should be that treating chronic lifestyle diseases that are preventable with a healthy diet adds enormously to the costs of Medicare and Medicaid and to the escalating federal debt. I don't think we've even begun to grasp the true costs that we are paying for the standard American diet.
No.
62% of the calories in which come from ultra-processed food and full of sugar. Mark, what are some of the prices that we often don't see, but we are paying economically and otherwise?
I mean, there's so many externalized costs, right? We don't actually pay for the cost of the food at the stand. If we had to pay for the cost of a can of Coke, it should probably be $20 in terms of its effect on our economy, our environment, the way we grow the corn syrup, effect on climate change, the effect on health, the effect on our healthcare system. I mean, these are all externalized costs that actually that are not being paid by the person at the register. They're being paid by our economy as a whole and so forth. So I think that the consequences of our current food system are enormous. One, this healthcare crisis, you started to mention it, but one in two people have a lifestyle preventable chronic disease. One in $5 in America is used for healthcare. 84% of those dollars are for lifestyle preventable diseases. And that's costing a huge amount of money in terms of federal debt, because Medicare and Medicaid are the biggest drivers of our federal debt. And it will soon eclipse our entire federal budget if we continue at the current rate, meaning there'll be no money left for roads, for education, for the military, for anything. And of course, you know, we have an achievement gap. I don't know if people realize this, but the kids who are overweight, the kids who eat junk food, do not perform well in school, graduate less from school, don't go to college, end up with lower incomes. And is a huge bunch of data on this by Dr. Bosch at Columbia, who's written all about this achievement gap. And then this national security issues are huge. I mean, I met with General Jack Keane not too long ago, and he was telling me that 70% of recruits for the military are unfit to serve, which is stunning to me.
These are topics and issues that affect people's lives in profound ways. We have normalized things in our culture that are killing us. Last year, for example, we learned that Coca-Cola, the world's largest producer of sugary beverages, has been providing millions of dollars in funding to researchers who have been downplaying the link between sugary drinks and obesity. And then a few months ago, we learned that candy makers are funding studies that purport to prove that children who eat candy weigh less than those who don't eat candy. Now, on one level, these things are absurd to the point of being ridiculous. But on the other, these companies are spending millions of dollars, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars, on these efforts because they are getting results for that spending. They are controlling what people are thinking. They are controlling what government policy does and does not dictate. And that keeps them ensconced in control of our lives and our health. And the consequences are so severe that when I think of sugar as the new tobacco, as you've said, I think that's entirely accurate.
It actually, they have this, like, the same script, right? You know, they emphasize personal responsibility. It's all about, you know, personal choice, and all calories are the same, and it doesn't matter if it comes from soda or broccoli. As long as you don't eat too many calories, you'll be fine. It basically says it's all about exercise. You should. I mean, they have this front group called this. I think it's the Center for Consumer Freedom, and they basically say it's all about the exercise and not about the calories. And then they won't reveal their funding sources because they're afraid of the militant, you know, gun-toting vegetarians out there who are going to attack them or something. I don't know.
They don't want to reveal their funding sources because their funding sources are the corporations that are profiting from selling us these lousy, crappy foods.
And then they pay these scientists, like you said, to deliver research that creates doubt. They criticize, quote, junk science that finds harm, so they try to discredit science. There was a report put out by McMaster that sugar is not a problem. I mean, it was all funded by the sugar industry and the processed food industry. They make pledges that they can regulate themselves. They lobby massively to government, like the $30 million on the latest election for soda tax prevention. They introduce, quote, safer products, like, you know, it's like low tar, low nicotine cigarettes, right?
Yeah. So there's probably an analogy then between those low tar, low nicotine cigarettes, as they were called, at supposedly a healthier way of smoking, and the artificially sweetened, no calorie beverages.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I just read a study. I don't know if you saw it came out recently, John. It was comparing aspartame, I think, you know, sucralose, and stevia. And comparing all these, even the quote natural sweeteners, and compared them in terms of how they affected, comparing to regular sugar, how they affected the overall response of your insulin and all these sort of biological responses. And they're actually, at the end of a 3-hour period, there was no difference in if you had a soda or a stevia sweetened soda. I mean, Coke now has this Coke Green, which is sold in some places like in Mexico, which is basically looks like it's green and healthy, and it's sweetened with stevia. I think it's still a problem.
There are a lot of ways that the food industry has learned to hijack our taste buds and to get us hooked on foods that, you know, that the more you eat, the more you want kind of thing, which is the definition of addiction, really. I want to ask you about casein, and I want to ask you about gluten. Do these substances also have addictive properties?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, she asked him. I'm a regular doctor. I see patients all day. I just saw patients all day today. And, you know, I saw a little autistic kid who had very high levels of caseomorphins, which are, I collect the urine and you find these proteins that are kind of partially digested molecules of casein, which is from dairy. And these are, they're called caseomorphins, like morphine, because they're opiate-like peptides that affect the brain and cause craving, addiction, and inflammation. They also block the brain for these autistic kids, blocking some of the folate receptors, which affects their brain chemistry and their brain function. And gluten also is the same thing. It causes gluteomorphins, and you see them in schizophrenics and autistic kids. And, you know, it's addictive. You know, think about it. No one binges on a bag of avocados, right? But easily people can finish off a bag of cookies, right?
I once tried to binge on a bag of avocados.
It's hard.
It didn't work.
And my daughter, when she was 3, she loved Brussels sprouts so much, she ate so many, she ended up throwing up. But
well, you're lucky that was your daughter's go-to comfort food.
I couldn't get her to eat Brussels sprouts for years after that.
Yes, I could imagine.
It's pretty frightening. And casein and gluten also, you know, are linked to all sorts of inflammatory conditions. It seems that when you look at the biology of this, the molecules in casein that we have now, there's different forms of casein. And when we had heirloom cows that weren't, you know, this homogenous, I mean, I read the other day an article where I was like one bull that's, you know, fertilized, you know, 30 million cows or something like that.
Yeah, it's a homogeneous population genetically now.
Yeah, exactly. And then this genetics of these new cows creates different casein molecules that seem to be more inflammatory, more allergenic, that's been linked to type 1 diabetes, autoimmune diseases, and gluten also. Gluten, we've seen a dramatic increase in reaction to gluten that's real. It's everybody who eats gluten increases the leakiness of their gut to some degree, and that may not be symptomatic, but it increases the slow-level inflammation.
Mark, we have so many lifestyle diseases. We have such a lousy standard American diet. It's so many people suffering and so many costs accruing.
It's called the SAD diet.
The SAD, yes, literally. A number of our leaders in the food movement have been proposing that we have a national food policy. And yeah. I know you want that. We want that at the Food Revolution Network. We're working for that. If you were in charge of a national food policy, what would it entail?
Well, I have very clear ideas of what to do. One is we need to stop the targeting of food marketing to children and to the rest of us of foods that we know are harmful. Sugar, sweetened beverages, processed food. These are the leading causes of childhood obesity. They lead to racial disparities in health, especially in African-American, Latin populations. I mean, the average American kid, average African-American kid has 60% of them have a soda every day. 30% of white kids have a soda every day. We don't have clear food labeling. We have very confusing food labels. You have to be a PhD in nutrition, and good luck with that. I mean, I read the labels, and this is what I do for a living, and it's still confusing. And you know, it's designed to confound and confuse. It should be red, don't eat this, or eat at your own risk. Orange, you know, eat with caution, and green, eat as much as you want. So anybody can understand what's going on. I mean, for example, the government says on one hand through the USDA to, in our dietary guidelines, to reduce added sugars. But well, actually they were asked to by the Dietary Advisory Committee to say eat less sugar sweetened beverages, but they changed it to added sugar. But on the label, it doesn't say added sugar. So how do you know what you're eating? Right, so that's an example.
Mark, I hear you saying that we need to stop the marketing of junk food to kids, and we need to have food labels that are clear and easy to understand. I agree with you about those things. And I'm thinking also about the Farm Bill and how we now subsidize the least healthy foods.
We subsidize commodities, right? Soy, corn, wheat, which are turned into high fructose corn syrup, soybean oil, refined starchy flour, which have been directly linked to obesity. You know, only 1% of the Farm Bill supports healthier foods. For example, prices of soda have gone down 40% since the 1970s, while the price of fruit and vegetables have gone up almost 40%. A food stamp program I would address as well. They're called SNAP. They support processed food consumption.
It is a little absurd that the SNAP program is so supportive of processed foods. It really should be more encouraging of whole foods. And I'm reminded of the programs that have doubled the value of SNAP benefits when they're used to buy fresh vegetables and fruits. These programs have been very successful. They were originally started in 2009 in Detroit by the national nonprofit Fair Food Network. They launched what was then called Double Up Food Bucks as originally a 6-week pilot in 5 farmers markets. It was very successful. And since then, the program has really grown. It's grown to more than 200 sites across Michigan, including farmers markets, grocery stores, CSAs, food share programs, mobile food trucks, and farm stands. And it's now operating successfully in more than 18 states. Under these programs, SNAP benefit recipients can get double the dollar value of their benefits when they buy fresh produce. I think that's terrific. I think it's a major step in the right direction. But still, nationally, the single biggest line item in the SNAP program is soda. The government spends something like $7 billion a year buying soda for people through the SNAP program. Mark, if you were in charge of a national food policy, would you put a tax on sugar?
I would definitely tax sugar and maybe even sugar-sweetened beverages. And that includes your lattes with 500 calories of sugar at Starbucks. People are going to hate me for that, but yes. you know, we know that the guidelines really, I mean, the research really shows that taxing sugar-sweetened beverages results in reduced consumption and provides a funding source, like you said, John, for public health measures to fight obesity. We need to regulate really irresponsible relationships between the food industry and nonprofits that aren't trusted with public health. Like I said, the American Nutrition and Dietetic Association, 40%. These are all our dietitians in America, right? 40% of their funding every year comes from the food industry. And they talk, and they fund, like I said, the King Center, NAACP. They call it corporate social responsibility. It's actually manipulation for their good and the social harm. And then we need to fund adequately science. I mean, I'm trying to do research in nutrition at Cleveland Clinic. I mean, I'm, you know, trying to raise money from philanthropists. You can't get money from pharma. You can't get money from the government to do the kind of research intervention we want. I'm just trying to, for example, create a research at Cleveland Clinic where we study people working together in groups, changing their lifestyle, changing their diet. I can't get funding for it. It's like, it's terrible. Antibiotics, another big thing. I would eliminate all antibiotics in animal feed, except treating animals for actual sickness, because they put children's and adults' health at risk because of drug-resistant superbugs. And I would really create an effort to oppose the food industry's actions, which are on the border of legality. I don't know if you know about this, John, but in Washington State, the state of Washington sued the Grocery Manufacturers of America, which is the front lobby group for the food industry, because they were trying to influence labeling legislation around GMOs. And they spent $11 million trying to influence this legislation not passing. And the food industry was sued, and the government won, and they had to pay $18 million, which was unprecedented. So I think these are all things we need to do, I think, if I was king for a day.
You know, you mentioned at one point the African American and Latino communities and how often they get hit hardest by these things. Every single demographic group in the country struggles with obesity and childhood obesity, but the disease takes a particularly dramatic toll on minorities and among adults and among children. Obesity is far worse in the African American and in the Latin American populations. There's a very recent study, it was published in the journal Pediatric Obesity, and it found that the fast food chains, the soda makers, and snack vendors are deliberately and increasingly targeting Black and Latino teens and kids in their ads. And nearly all of these youth-targeted food ads are for sugary drinks and sweets and snacks and fast foods. There's a lot of discussion taking place these days about kids and healthy eating and obesity. Michelle Obama got the ball rolling on these conversations in a lot of ways. The World Health Organization is recommending that governments protect kids from junk food ads. But here in the United States, there seems to be no agreement that even the youngest of children should be protected from junk food marketing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, you know this, but, you know, I think the average two-year-old can recognize food that they've seen on TV in the store and ask their parents for it. And the, you know, two-year-olds, they whine, they cry, they scream until they get it. And then the other thing, and, you know, I remember my daughter, she was, I think, maybe 10 at the time, 9 maybe. She said, "Dad, you know, how come when you see the commercials on TV and then you see the actual thing, it doesn't seem like that at all? It's like they're tricking you."
Wow, they sure are.
Until they're 8, can't tell the difference between real life and commercials.
No, and then the food industry takes advantage of that, exploits kids, their innocence. I think our responsibility as adults is to protect our kids from that type of predatory corporate behavior. And it just amazes me that we still haven't done that. We still haven't created the protections. I mean, some of us as parents try to. We try to keep our kids from these exposures. But it's an uphill battle because the culture at large has normalized it.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. I mean, I as a doctor, I mean, as a physician treating patients, I see the effects of this. And it's frightening. And knowing what I know and having, you know, really dove into the science for the last 20 years, you know, I think it's criminal. I really do. I think it's criminal. I think we should take legal action against the food industry. I think the example of Washington's great. I think there's far more things we can do. I think the government, who knows what's going to happen. Even Obama backpedaled. Even Michelle Obama backpedaled. The amount of force was so powerful from the food industry. I remember I had a conversation with Ann Veneman, who was the agriculture secretary under George Bush. And I said, how come we couldn't eliminate soda, with food stamps, you know, using food stamps advice. Or how come we couldn't make the dietary guidelines match science instead of food industry needs? How can we can't do simple things like change food labeling to make it clear what's safe and not to eat? And she said, Mark, the truth is that the food industry has a lock on the White House and the Congress. And I'm like, you know, that's the problem. It's money and politics.
Yes, money and politics is such a problem. You know, Mark, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are listening to us right now and who are appalled by the extent that the food industry controls public policy for their own profits and at the expense of public health. I'm sure there are a lot of our listeners who know this is happening. They're disgusted by it. They want to protect themselves and their families. They know they cannot rely on getting support from government, and they're certainly not getting any support from the food industry. Mark, you've been a voice of guidance and inspiration for health-conscious people for a long time, and I know you interact with people all the time who care about these things. What do you say to them?
I mean, I think the first thing is that, you know, a lot of people blame themselves for the state of their health, and, you know, it's really what the food industry trains people to think. It's my fault that I'm fat. You know, I just need to control myself. And the truth is, in the toxic food environment, it's very hard to do that. And I think the first thing I want people to understand is that this is not your fault, and that you can become empowered to learn how to care for your body, that it's not rocket science, that if you eat real whole food, it just works. It does, you know, and there are all kinds of variations of real whole food, but it's essentially, you know, I do these lectures at churches, and I get up and I say, you know, it's really simple what to eat. Just ask yourself a simple question. Did God make this or did man make this? And if man made it, you shouldn't eat it. If God made it, fine to eat. You know, pretty much simple
right.
rule.
Right.
And I think people just need to realize that they can be empowered and that food is medicine and that many of the things that they're suffering from can go away if by changing their diet. And, you know, I think I had a guy today I just talked to who was diabetic, you know, 50 pounds overweight, you know, high blood pressure, sexual function was terrible, you know, just dwindling. And he's now 69 years old. He says, Mark, I'm 69. I'm playing racquetball. I'm doing sprints and interval training. I lost 50 pounds. I feel better than I did at 40. I'm like, so I want people to understand that you can change this direction at any point in your life. And it's just by just knowing that through choosing real whole food and doing some simple things for lifestyle, it's radically effective.
It is. And I often wish more people understood how radically effective eating a whole foods, plant-strong diet can be. You mentioned the guy you talked to today who lost 50 pounds and feels so much younger and better. I hear stories like that all the time from people who've begun eating more vegetables and more fruits and legumes, more mushrooms and seeds and nuts and whole grains and less sugar, less processed foods and less animal products. And they tell me consistently that they are experiencing stunning, dramatic improvements in their health. They're thrilled with what has happened for them. And when they started eating, as you said, the food that God made rather than the food that man made, so many bright things started happening in their lives. A lot of people are learning today that our bodies have tremendously powerful self-healing mechanisms. Once we start providing our bodies with the right fuel, the food we evolved to eat, we begin to thrive in all kinds of ways. Our minds get clearer. We become less susceptible to negative thinking and to fear. Our emotions become more resilient. We bounce back more easily from adversity. We become more vital, more vibrant, more filled with energy and creativity. We start responding to stress in more creative and resourceful ways. Our energy stays with us all day. It just doesn't come and go. We find our power.
We are the most powerful forces. I mean, it's our choices that allow the food industry to do what they're doing. You know, soda consumption has gone down significantly. I mean, they're trying to push all sorts of other products, and they're buying other companies that are producing healthier food. So I think, you know, there are shifts happening. I think this is last evidence of a cycle of the election with soda taxes. I think we're realizing there needs to be a shift. And I'm, you know, it's really what my main focus is now, is really how do we start to change the conversation about food to highlight these issues. I'm working with the New York Times and Bloomberg group to sort of elucidate how, you know, these issues of food injustice and the food policies we have and how corrupt they are, and sort of do sort of investigative journalism around this to help our population understand what's really going on.
You know, there's a social power to this. There's a study, I'm sure you know, you're aware of it. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they found that people were most likely to become obese when their friends became obese.
And even
if your friend lived hundreds of miles away, the influence was there.
But
bad habits are contagious, but maybe good ones are too. I mean, I haven't seen studies, but when people lose weight and become more fit and become more connected to their natural healing powers, do you think their friends are more likely to do so too?
Absolutely. I mean, if your friends are, having Big Mac's fries and, you know, a big gulp every day and watch TV all day, you're more likely to do that. And if your friends are, you know, drinking green juice and doing yoga, you're more likely to do that. And that's actually the insight that I had when I was in Haiti and, you know, worked with Paul Farmer, who actually created transformation in healthcare in Haiti by using the power of community and each other. So he took people and created community health workers to help deal with AIDS and TB. I realized that, you know, that obesity and diabetes were also contagious, like you said. That's Christakis's work. And I also realized that, wow, maybe health is contagious. And that's why we created this program at this church, Saddleback in California, where we got 15,000 people to lose 250,000 pounds by helping each other, doing it together. I mean, these people were huge. They were drinking big gulps. There was soda everywhere. They had ice cream socials. They had pancake breakfast. They even had like ribs for breakfast once for the men. It was terrible. And it all changed just on a dime by changing the culture, having people help each other. Very powerful.
Well, that's what we're trying to do. It's what we want to do is create that type of a change throughout the culture as a whole. And I want to thank you, Mark, because you've been a leader in this for a long time, and you still are. When you mentioned your work at Saddleback Church, that, of course, is Rick Warren's church. And he was himself very, very heavy, and I believe lost a lot of weight as part of his whole congregation doing this.
Absolutely.
Well, you've helped a lot of people. And one of the things I most appreciate about you, Mark, is that you genuinely want to help people to be healthy and fit and happy. It's been a pleasure, as always, to talk with you today. And on behalf of Ocean and myself and everyone involved in the food revolution, I want to thank you for your great work and for being with us today.
Thank you so much, John and Ocean. It's always great talking to you guys.
We've been talking with Dr. Mark Hyman, author of 10 number one New York Times best-selling books, including The Blood Sugar Solution and Eat Fat, Get Thin. Mark, you have a potent and keen diagnosis of what's wrong. And more importantly, you have brilliant and galvanizing ideas for what's possible. Your message is powerful, it's inspiring, and it's changing millions of lives. We want to thank you for your time, for your profound insights, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you so much.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.